From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now, and there are still two races that are too close to call from yesterday. In Kansas, Secretary of State Kris Kobach, an immigration hardliner and Trump favorite, is ahead of Governor Jeff Collier in the Republican primary race for the governor's seat by about 200 votes out of more than 300,000 cast.
That's very close. And in Ohio, the president's candidate, Republican Troy Balderson, is just narrowly ahead of the Democrat Danny O'Connor to fill that longtime Republican-held seat in the 12th congressional district. Democratic National Committee Chair Tom Perez was pleased on CNN today.
There are 60 seats for the House, 60 seats or so, that are more competitive than this race yesterday. And so, as I look at this race, and again, we don't know who's going to win yet, but, you know, close to a dead heat. And I look at the landscape, not only in that district, but across America. This gives me optimism, not only about this.
Let's bring in NPR's Jessica Taylor to start us off. Jessica, should Democrats be this pleased? Yes, this should have been a shoo-in Republican seat. That has obviously eroded. But is this what Democrats are thinking, or does this have to do with this race?
Well, I think that we really saw this race as a bellwether for where Democrats could be competitive in the fall. And this is not just sort of a one-off. This continues a trend that we have seen dating back to the 2016 election of Democrats overperforming in special elections, including in places that are heavily Republican. This was a suburban Columbus district that President Trump carried by 11 points. It's been in Republican hands for almost four decades, and it's a place where this really shouldn't have even been competitive, really. And so, yes, I think Republicans are, you know, on the face breathing a sigh of relief that they won. But when it boils down to it, there's a lot of warning signs for them. This was the type of district, as the DNC chairman Tom Perez noted, there's actually almost 70 seats that are more competitive for Democrats than this one. And so the fact that they came so close in this place really does sort of send off warning bells for, you know, I think that we knew that the House was in play before this, and it just underscores how vulnerable Republicans are in some of these suburban type districts, affluent, highly educated areas. This is sort of their weak spot.
Well, and just to be clear, Jessica, you said the Republicans are pleased that they won. NPR has not called this race yet, neither has the Associated Press, right? It's still
considered too close. Republicans are declaring victory. Balderson declared victory last night. Yes, exactly. We do not know the outcome. And, you know, but if it holds, then Balderson, you know, he is ahead. There are about 3,400 outstanding provisional ballots. Some of those typically break Democrats' way, but O'Connor would still need to win an overwhelming majority of those, and that could then trigger if it's within half of a percent, it would trigger an automatic recount. There's over 5,000 absentee ballots that haven't been returned. There's still a lot of unknowns, yes, but Republicans, they are declaring victory.
Well, should the president declare victory? He tweeted last night, when I decided to go to Ohio for Troy Balderson, he was down in early voting, 64-36. That's not good. After my speech, there was a big turn for the better. How are Republicans feeling about this? Did the president help or hurt Balderson?
I think that he did a little bit of both. I think that where he helped him was to tighten this, because we saw when the first returns came in last night, there were early voting. O'Connor had a major lead, including in some Republican areas. And when we saw Election Day votes come in, especially from the rural parts of the district that are more Republican, that is where Trump does really well, he did boost turnout in that area. So I think that he did help them in that regard. And what the president is able to do, he is able to energize his base, get them to come out. But we still see overall a more energized Democratic electorate that is just motivated on the face of it. And I think that, you know, too, he motivated some people to come out, independents too, to come out for O'Connor. And you saw, I think someone else who made a huge difference in this race was the Ohio Governor John Kasich, who's been a vocal critic of Trump, even floated primarying him in 2020 after running in 2016. I think the fact that he endorsed Balderson, that they convinced him to weigh in this race, helped him too, because he's still popular in a lot of these areas. So I think that, yes, Trump did make a difference, but there are areas where he's not going to be helpful for them, bottom line, when you look at the whole 2018 map.
Okay. The other race that we've been watching that's still too close to call is further to the west. And let's bring in Brian Ellison of KCUR in Kansas City. Brian, this is the governor's race in Kansas, and the president that president the candidate that President Trump endorsed is ahead. That's Kris Kobach, who was in charge of that Trump Election Integrity Commission, which went searching for election fraud and then quietly disbanded after not finding any. He's up against the sitting governor, who was a lieutenant governor. That would be Jeff Collier. What's going on in this one?
Yeah, it's been a nail biter. Both candidates actually sent their supporters home from their watch parties without knowing the result. And then just before 8 o'clock this morning, the last county, Johnson County, right here in the Kansas City area, the state's most populous county, had a lot of problems with voting machines, long lines at polling places. They finally released their final results, and it gave Kobach, as you said, just a 191-vote lead. That would represent a victory for the president in the sense that he endorsed Kris Kobach just the day before the election. That's not a surprise, of course.
But wasn't Kobach also seen as the one who would be weaker in a general election?
Many people think so. He is certainly evokes stronger negative emotions from Democrats as well as moderates in the state. Incumbent Jeff Collier, certainly very conservative, but not nearly as disliked as Kobach. Further complicating the life, though, for the Democrats is the presence of an independent candidate, Greg Orman, who actually just 2 years ago ran a strong race, an unsuccessful one for the U.S. Senate as an independent. He will probably be competing for some of the same votes as the Democratic nominee last night, State Senator Laura Kelly from Topeka.
Okay, the Republican Governors Association, I want to point out, advised President Trump against endorsing Kobach. So Democrats are going to be happy, actually, if he does win. But we'll keep an eye on that, 191 votes. But I want to ask you, Brian, about the union vote there. The referendum yesterday in Missouri, voters rejected that state's anti-union law, which prevented private sector unions from asking for fees from workers who weren't members but who benefited from the union's collective bargaining. Now, earlier this year, the Supreme Court ruled public sector unions essentially can't collect those fees. But this was about private sector unions in this vote. And it seems as if the unions won. They can now require non-union workers to pay this fee for benefits the unions get them. Here's AFL-CIO Treasurer Liz Schuler speaking in Kansas City last night.
A lot of people want to write the labor movement's obituary. They think we're dead, but it's far from the case. We're actually we're on the move.
Brian, what's the feeling there?
Yeah, it certainly does come off as a strong victory for the unions in Missouri as well as the rest of the country. You know, there are 27 right-to-work states now, and Missouri had a lot of celebration on the Republican side by becoming the 28th state last year when the legislature passed this law. It was a very rarely used element of the Missouri Constitution that allowed a petition to force this law to the ballot before it took effect, and that was the vote we had yesterday. You know, Democrats wanted to see this voted on the November general election ballot because they knew it would drive Democratic voters to the polls. Republicans, who control the state legislature, got it on the August ballot instead. And as we saw yesterday, there was a great deal of bipartisan support for stopping this law from taking effect. And as you say, it was victory for the unions, who poured millions of dollars both in-state and from out-of-state into television ads that made this about more than just labor and more than just about unions, but about the economic security of all Missourians. Hmm.
It's Brian Ellison of KCUR. Brian, thank you. And Jessica, I want to just go back to you for one more piece of congressional news that we've got today, which is that another ally of the president's has been arrested. That is Chris Collins, Republican congressman of New York, charged with federal securities fraud connected to a company in Sydney, Australia. He's a shareholder. Today, the House Speaker called for a prompt and thorough investigation. They pulled him off of one of the committees that he sits on. What does this mean for Republicans and for President Trump?
I mean, Collins was the first Republican member of the House to endorse Trump's bid. This was before he, you know, had a lot of Republicans, national Republicans coming out for him and things, too. So I think that, you know, what it does, it sort of feeds into this disarray of people around President Trump not playing by the rules, allegedly. You know, this is still new. It's unusual for them to indict a sitting elected official, especially during an election year, certainly. And, you know, it is sort of new territory. we haven't seen a lot of politicization around this yet. I think it's early, but as unsurprising in our politics, I'm sure that we will see Democrats seize upon this as just further evidence that there is allegedly all this corruption around President Trump and his allies and things too. And Collins is not considered an especially vulnerable member of Congress. He's in a very pretty safe Republican seat in the Buffalo area. But, you know, something like this, I think, could certainly impact his race. We will have to see.
According to the indictment, a company in Australia got bad results about a drug for multiple sclerosis. Trading was halted in Australia, not in the U.S. And Collins is alleged to have shared that information with his son, who sold his shares. His son, the father of his son's fiancée, I believe, also allegedly sold his shares. So a little insider stuff there if it happened. NPR's Jessica Taylor. Boy, Jessica, you know, Jeremy and I are thinking, you know, I wonder if we're going to have enough to talk about. It's just, there's so much. So thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you for having me.
And we also spoke with Brian Ellison of KCUR. Our thanks to Brian as well.
This is Here and Now. Here's to the good times we gonna have. You don't need money, got a free pass. Here's to the fact that I'd be sad without you. I want you to have it all. You're listening to Have It All. It is the lead single off of the latest album from Jason Mraz, which is called No, K-N-O-W. It is out this week. Mraz is 41. He grew up in rural Virginia, and he's won 2 Grammys. His music spans many genres, from reggae to rap to country. But one thing that is evident regardless of style is a feel-good vibe.
The through line for me is always vocally driven, positive articulation, some stuff that you can sing along to no matter what the genre is.
Let's talk about that positive articulation. I mean, you would definitely be described, I think, as feel-good.
Yeah.
Is that by design, or do you think that's just what comes naturally?
A little of both. As a songwriter, I do write songs when I'm sad. I do write songs when I'm frustrated, but those aren't the ones I'm going to bring to the stage, because a stage is typically a place where I've asked 1,000 or 5,000 people to gather to sing and dance and have a good time. So feel-good songs are what I want to bring to that event. Singing makes me feel good. And when I feel good, I sing, and then singing makes me feel good, and it just escalates and becomes a constant feel-good experience.
Just to give people an idea of what we're talking about here, let's listen to a little bit of a song off of your new album. This is called Might As Well Dance. We got nothing to lose. Might as well take off our pants. Now, in the music video for this song, you actually have footage from your wedding day to your wife,
right,
Christina. You call this new album a love letter to her.
Yeah. And for the video, we had not yet shared our wedding video except with those who attended. And as you know, we were sitting in bed one night looking at through different clips that we might be able to use for a video about dancing. We said, well, what if we put a couple of clips from our wedding video of dancing? And then once we started looking at that old footage again, we realized we should just make the entire video about our wedding, because that song started out as a voice memo to her on her voicemail while I was traveling, and I thought it would be a fun way to honor the song.
I hear a lot of people actually use your songs at their weddings. Did you use any of your own songs at your wedding?
I did, but nothing that's been released. The one I used at a wedding was a song I wrote for my wife called The Best Thing I Can Do For You Is Clean Our House.
And it, you didn't want to release that one?
No, not yet. Maybe someday. Maybe, yeah. But it has lines such as, and clean the litter box. You know, very specific things to our daily routines.
How do you stay so upbeat in the face of everything that everyone in this country is dealing with right now? There's a lot of tough things in the news.
Well, I feel that my position can be one that says, let's not forget about love, right? And it's hard to love the other side of the aisle, whatever aisle you're on, you know, whatever side of the street or the protest you're on. It's truly hard to love. But what I feel is that we all wake up here in 2000 whatever, and we inherit a really gnarly history, a very violent history. And yet we also stand in a really powerful place where the future isn't written yet. And we can, through loving action, rewrite history, change rules, change laws, and help all of humanity. I certainly don't think investing more money and might in military and weaponry is going to create world peace. So I've always been one who stands for love. And if I can stand in the middle of that protest and help people hold hands and see their own humanity in each other's eyes, then maybe that can help resolve some issues.
We're talking about your new album here today, but I actually want to play a song that I've recently discovered from your 2012 album. This is called 93 Million Miles.
Oh, my beautiful mother, she told me, son, in life you're gonna go far. If you do it right, you'll love where you are. Just know.
What were you thinking about when you wrote this song?
Couple of things. First, it was a thank you to my parents because they gave me permission to pursue the arts as a career path. You know, and they said, look, you can always come back home. You can always work back in Richmond, Virginia, my hometown. But go for it. Live your dream, because if you do what you love and you can love what you do, then you've won. You know, that's success. So the song is a thank you to my parents, but it's also a little bit of about science, or at least elevation. My favorite thing about traveling is when you're up in the airplane and you look back down at Earth and you see, sometimes you can even see sort of the curvature of the Earth. Mm-hmm. And when you look at cities and the urban sprawl, you know, every single one of us just seems so empty and meaningless. Whereas when you're down on the Earth, everything's relative and everything seems so important and traffic seems like a nightmare.
Right.
So it's that little bit of distance when you zoom out that is the reminder of how fragile we are and how precious we are. And so it reminds me to just be more loving and grateful for the limited time we have here.
When you look back on some of your older songs, do you ever listen to them now and say, I wish I would have done this differently?
Oh, yeah, totally. I cringe at some of my older material. Right. But I also know that I was in my 20s. I was in my early 20s for a lot of that material. And what's on your mind, at least my mind in my early 20s, was trying to get the girl and where's the next party? And it's not dissimilar to many young people's songs about going to the club and trying to say, look at me. So very ego-driven songs. I can't sing those songs today because it's just not who I am. Hmm. And so I do end up retiring quite a bit of my material. But as a writer, I'm always excited about the new things I'm writing. So my show still has plenty of music.
Well, and one song that you probably will never be able to retire is perhaps your biggest hit, which is I'm Yours. I want to listen to a little bit of that.
There's no need to complicate our time.
Why do you think that that was such a hit?
I don't know, because if I did know, I would try to write more of them, for sure. But this song, I like to say that song's written in primary colors and has a melody that reminded me of a nursery rhyme, something I would have sung in preschool, kindergarten, etc. And it was also, when I wrote it, it wasn't about anyone in particular. It was more about my love of singing and closing my eyes and surrendering to whatever energy and entity inspires one to write or dream or sing. And when I finally recorded it about 4 years later, I did have a girlfriend. So I sang it with a little more emphasis on, you know, on a little more swagger, I guess. Lyrics like scooch on over closer, dear. That wasn't in the original. But I think that giving away that generosity is something that resonates with people, especially those who are getting married or who want to give their life or their time to something. I think that song really resonates.
You've mentioned former girlfriend, your wife, going after the girl. I want to ask you, though, about a love letter that you wrote to the LGBT community during Pride Month. And you had a line in a poem that said, "I am by your side," with bi spelled B-I. So what did you mean by that?
Well, I was making an example of my own sexual preferences, which at times have been on either, you know, the female gender or the male gender. So bisexuality, if you will. And as I was writing this letter that Billboard asked me to write, I realized I couldn't write it to a community that stood over there. Mm. I was with that community. So it felt almost like a lie to say, "I'm with you." It felt more comforting and more authentic of me to say, "Yeah, this is who I am. I've been able to stand on both sides." And, you know, being the B in LGBT is sort of the one that's least, I don't know, it has the least potency, if you will. So it's never been something, I would honestly, most of my life, I assume that everyone must be B until they land their identity. But for me, I do feel comfortable in my being. And in fact, one of my working titles for this new album, which is called No, K-N-O-W, was LG Me-T, and where I put me as the letter B.
Why did you decide against that one?
You know what? I didn't want to make that the only conversation about this record. And by the end of the process, the album became 10 love letters to my wife, which is great. But it just didn't match the that title didn't really match the final curation of the record. Plus, my last album was called Yes, and I couldn't pass up the opportunity to have an album called No.
That's Jason Mraz, singer-songwriter. His new album is called No. It is out this week. Jason, thank you so much for joining us.
Yeah, my pleasure. Thanks for having me on your program.
And you can find out more about Jason's tour at hereandnow.org.
If you're spending time alone, if it's just you and your phone, taking pictures of yourself, baby, maybe I can help. It could be love, and we could be homies, but once you get to know me, I could be your one and only. I could make you unlonely, we could take it slowly, and we could keep it low. Make you unknown, love, la 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 la, love, la la la, one and only. I can make you be loved, la la la, give me homies. Once you get to know me, love, la la, I could be your one and only. I can make you unlonely.
This message comes from NPR's sponsor, Indeed. When it comes to hiring, you don't have time to waste. You need help getting to your short list of qualified candidates fast. With Indeed, post a job in minutes, set up screener questions, then zero in on qualified candidates. And when you need to hire fast, accelerate your results with sponsored jobs. New users can try for free when you sign up at Indeed.com/NPR podcast. Terms, conditions, and quality standards apply.
Tesla stock slipped this morning after a big 10% boost yesterday following the news that Tesla could be going private. Yesterday, the company's CEO, Elon Musk, tweeted that he planned to take the company private at a price of $420 a share if shareholders approved it. Later in the day, the company released a blog post saying there was no final decision yet about that move. Joining us now is Callum Borchers, senior innovation reporter at WBUR. Callum, yesterday people were talking about the fact that Elon Musk may just be crazy, that these tweets just seemed not right. Trading was even halted for a bit. What do we know today?
Well, What we know so far is that there's no final decision, but that Musk is clearly leaning toward taking this company private. And in the follow-up blog post that he authored last evening, he made it quite clear that while he may bring Tesla back to the public market later, he really does want to bring it back behind closed doors again.
What does it mean to take the company private at a certain price? He used $420 a share. How does that work?
Well, so what he's planning to do is to give his investors a choice, right? So you can either keep your stake in the company as a private investor, or you can be bought out at $420. And so you saw the price go up yesterday, probably for one of a couple of reasons, or maybe some combo. One may be that some investors want to get in now while they still have a chance, and they believe the company is going to thrive as a private entity. Or they're just trying to get in and essentially flip it because the $420 price would be a premium. It would be a pretty nice return.
Right now, it's around $370 a share.
Exactly. And so if you buy in around then, in fact, $420 is higher than Tesla has ever traded. So you would stand to gain a profit if you wanted to flip at that price.
So why was trading halted? Who shut that down and why?
So NASDAQ regulators shut it down for about 2 hours. And a halt on trading usually happens when there is some kind of major news that both sellers and buyers need time to absorb. So it could be a big acquisition or something like that. And it's really just sort of a protection to make sure that investors are making informed decisions.
This is why companies don't do what Elon Musk did and just share things that are market movers in a tweet.
Well, that's right. A halt is often more planned than what we saw yesterday. Sometimes it takes the form of a delayed opening. So, right, maybe a company knows that day they're going to make some big announcement and they don't begin trading on the market right away, again, to give investors time to make their informed decisions and absorb the news. NASDAQ regulators didn't really seem to know what to make. In fact, there was some speculation among analysts yesterday that Musk might just be joking around with everybody. We've seen him do that before on April Fool's Day, right? He joked that Tesla was maybe going to go bankrupt.
Well, and the fact that he used 420 as the number, some people looked at that and said that's got another connotation involving marijuana. So that maybe he was talking about that. We don't know. Would taking Tesla private, though, solve the company's problems? Because it is having production issues.
Right. So Tesla recently hit a milestone of manufacturing about 5,000 of the Model 3 sedans a week. That's a good mark, but some analysts wonder if it's sustainable. It's notable to me that in that blog post outlining his rationale, Musk did not say production problems were among the things he was trying to solve. What he really seems to be trying to do is lift some of the pressure to hit certain earnings and manufacturing milestones. He wants to have the freedom to make decisions that might hurt the company in the short term, but that he believes will pay off in the long run.
That is Callum Borchers, senior innovation reporter at WBUR. We will watch what happens with Tesla. Callum, thank you.
Glad to be with you.
Today, a federal judge in Texas decides whether he will end DACA, the program that protects young undocumented immigrants brought to the U.S. as children. The judge is seen as unfriendly to the program in his previous rulings, so it's thought he'll rule in favor of the several states suing to end DACA, setting up a showdown in the Supreme Court with those who support it. So we'll keep an eye on that as we're looking this week at borders, very real lines for people who've crossed them or people who live along them. For most of us, though, borders exist in our imagination. We know about drug running through films like the Coen brothers' No Country for Old Men, the beleaguered sheriff played by Tommy Lee Jones.
I was sheriff of this county when I was 25 years old. Grandfather was a lawman, father too. The crime you see now, it's hard to even take its measure.
We also go to borders in books, in On the Black Hill by Bruce Chatwin. Twin brothers live in a farmhouse. One window looks out over the green fields of England, the other into Wales. The border runs up their staircase. Where does loyalty lie? Graham Greene's Stamboul Train follows passengers crossing borders on the Orient Express. Margaret Atwood's The Handmaid's Tale. Ofred and Luke try to escape over the Canadian border before she is made a handmaid, and then there are other boundaries she's not allowed to cross. Let's add to the list with Claudia Sadowski-Smith, who teaches literature at Arizona State University, where she specializes in border studies. She joins us from the studios of KNAU in Flagstaff, Arizona. Professor Sadowski-Smith, welcome.
Hi, thanks for having me.
What makes something a good border story?
The way I define border fictions is that this is literature, or these are cultural representations that actually look at or that are set at actual physical borders. So the border plays an important role. It is almost like another actor in the story.
So let's get to your list. The first one, The River Flows. This is the 2009 novel from Graciela Limon. Here's a reading of how the novel opens.
There is a pathway traveled by migrants that cuts away from the Mexican border as it slithers north to the Arizona desert up to Interstate 8. Migrants know this highway as La Ocho, the road that takes them to a better life, but the rail that leads to that highway is ruthless and unforgiving.
It follows a disparate group of migrants and their smugglers setting out to cross the desert from Sonora, Mexico into southwestern Arizona. It's one of the few cultural representations that actually focuses on crossings through the Arizona desert, to which migration shifted in the mid-1990s after the enforcement of urban corridors in California and in Texas. Mm-hmm. So the idea at the time was that the desert would act as a deterrent to migration, but what happened instead is migration continued and the number of border deaths actually increased. So we have a Salvadoran woman. She's her family's sole survivor of a massacre during El Salvador's civil wars, and she's trying to escape an abusive husband. We have an elderly Mexican man and his grandson who are searching for the remains of the daughter or mother. But the sheer difficulty of this six-day journey through the desert, experiencing these hardships in fictional form, asks us as readers to consider why people continue making these decisions to migrate, even knowing the difficulties of the trip. We actually don't get to see arrival at all, and it's ambiguous if any of the border crossers ever arrives.
Okay, again, so that's The River Flows. Let's go to Tropic of Orange, 1997, a Japanese-American author, Karen Tai Yamashita.
Yes. This is actually my favorite novel on the list, in that it portrays parallels between Asian Americans and Mexican Americans based on their very similar migration experiences. Two, for example, are a Latino reporter and his Japanese-American girlfriend who also works in the media, and they both realize the very personal effects of their family's migration histories that go back three generations. And then there's a first-generation ethnically Chinese immigrant from Singapore who came unaccompanied as a child with his brother disguised as a Vietnamese refugee.
Wow.
And he was socialized among Latinos in L.A., speaks Spanish. And then later on in the story, brings across the border a 12-year-old Chinese girl who may or may not be his biological cousin. He's approached by people smugglers called snakeheads from China, who brought her, just like many other hundreds of thousands of undocumented Chinese, from mainland China to Mexico.
Wow.
And so now he helps her cross the border. Another really interesting protagonist is a mythical 5-year-old laborer named Archangel. And at various points throughout the novel, he engages in various acts of performance art. And he's meant to represent undocumented border crossers of very diverse backgrounds. In one of his performances, he pulls the Tropic of Cancer. I can't really explain the whole thing. You have to read the novel. But it's the line dividing northern from southern Mexico and also the temperate from the subtropical climate zone. He pulls it across the border. And as a result of that act, time is altered. Climate in L.A. changes to that of southern Mexico. And so here we have the novel bringing together climate change and migration and showing us that climate change is becoming another factor contributing to migration. And then to with the conclusion of the novel, Archangel becomes a masked wrestler called El Gran Mojado, the big wet bag.
And there's more.
He fights another wrestler called Super Nafta.
Phantasmagoric. That's a Tropic of Orange, 1997. Here's a scene before the Archangel has that battle, when he's first heading north from Mexico to the U.S. and a crowd of villagers yells at him.
In the name of the Virgin of Guadalupe, go back, old man. Do you have a green card? Do you have a social security card? Do you have any money? When you get there, you will be unprotected. If you get sick, no one can give you care. If you have children, no one will teach them. In the name of Tonantzin and the memory of Juan Diego, go back. You are illegal.
Okay, The Guardians, a 2007 novel by Ana Castillo, set in a fictional New Mexican border town near El Paso, Texas. Just a little bit on that book.
It's supposedly set in the early 2000s when the numbers of border crossing deaths were still climbing. The novel itself does not look at the border crossings, but it humanizes the dead and disappeared by exploring how a border crosser's disappearance affects his family in the United States and also the local community. The novel looks at two sibling protagonists. They were brought to the United States by their parents. And while the sister actually receives U.S. citizenship through marriage and the mother through amnesty, the brother never gets his papers fixed. He crosses back and forth for work, but he needs the services of Mexican cartels that help migrants to cross. And these are cartels that have expanded their activities to migrant trafficking since the early 2000s. And he simply disappears during one of those crossings.
Oh, well, that sounds intense. That's The Guardians, a 2007 novel. So that's a partial list of books that Professor Sadowski-Smith from Arizona State University recommends about borders, novels that take you inside the story that most of us could never otherwise live. But we want to talk for a moment about film. First one you mentioned, the 1985 Oscar-nominated movie El Norte. Two Mayan siblings fleeing the Guatemalan Civil War, heading through Mexico, Los Angeles. Gripping.
Yes. So this film basically shows us that this migration from Central America is not new, that we're experiencing right now, and that has increased since about 2011. It goes back to the Civil Wars that I mentioned earlier. It's a very gripping film.
But I would think any film about border crossings or borders would be gripping.
Yes. I mean, they're really very challenging and complex cultural representations, both the novels and the films, because they're dealing with very, very difficult questions.
Yeah.
I mean, they're trying to show us not only a different way of thinking about the border and border crossings, but they're also trying to imagine solutions in some cases.
Well, because it is an incredible thing that humans do and have done forever. You know, people are always saying Jesus was a migrant, but despite the odds, people still do it, which is, you know, at the heart of any drama. So let's take a listen to another choice, 2009's Under the Same Moon, La Misma Luna, the 9-year-old Mexican boy's search for his undocumented mother in L.A.
My mom says, when I miss her, I should look at the moon because she'll be looking at it too. She's been working in America for 4 years, so she can bring me there soon.
Yeah, this is more of a mainstream film, and it is about an unaccompanied minor, and he's 9 years old, trying to find his mother. So it's a very gripping story that we've heard a lot about.
What do you see your students get out of these films and books?
They actually are very surprised because it gives them such a different view and different approach to an issue that they're bombarded with, especially, of course, in Metro Phoenix, which is about an hour and a half away from the border. So very often they come out of the class understanding with at least a more empathetic understanding of what immigrants go through, and also an understanding of why they're coming, why they continue coming, and how the United States is implicated in why they're coming.
That's Professor Claudia Sadowski-Smith, who teaches literature and border studies at Arizona State University. We'll have her list at herenow.org. Professor, thank you so much.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
So, your suggestions. Anything by Cormac McCarthy, right? A book we're just hearing about, German author Stefan Zweig's autobiography. When he fled the Nazis, he wrote, "The moment of crossing the border, I was already more free." But then he killed himself in despair that Nazis might win. Your border films and books here in Now.org.
All this week, we're focusing on a new housing crisis. People shut out of the market because of a lack of homes and rising prices. It's also a problem for renters in most major markets. The lack of apartments is leading to higher and higher rents. Well, the San Francisco Bay Area is the epicenter of California's housing crisis, with some of the highest housing costs and rents in the country. But as Matt Levin of nonprofit news site CalMatters reports, some residents are pushing back.
The moment Alex Shirenko saw the zucchini, he knew it was going to go viral.
Berkeley City Council meetings are kind of crazy places. When something happens, it's going to reverberate. And this was absolutely one of those moments, yeah.
Shirenko is a Berkeley-based housing activist. At a city council meeting last year, a developer was trying to get a permit to build two houses on a lot that only had one. But Berkeley has regulations about how much shadow can be cast by new housing. So to convince the city council to stop the project, Scout Shays, a neighbor who lives next door, brought a prop. This audio is from a public recording of the meeting.
I brought a zucchini because I love to garden, and in order to garden, you need sunlight. But the zucchini exists because I don't have a big two-story house next door to me right now.
Twitter quickly dubbed her the Zucchini Lady. She's become a symbol of the challenges to new housing development in the Bay Area. Housing activist Shirenko again.
Yeah, this is why it's hard to build new housing. All these issues kind of conflate together, and this is a big mess, and this is California.
For pretty much forever, developers across the country have fought regulatory hurdles standing in the way of new housing. But as home prices and rents have soared, a new voice has joined them. the YIMBYs.
YIMBY stands for Yes in My Backyard. It's about saying we need more homes.
Laura Foote Clark used to work in sales for Yelp, making $45,000 a year. She couldn't afford San Francisco, where a one-bedroom apartment now rents for $2,500. She got started with the YIMBYs after she got a letter in the mail from a nearby homeowner opposing a new development.
Heaven forbid a duplex, and it was going to be ugly, and the neighborhood needed to rally around and oppose this dangerous assault to neighborhood character. And I was like, am I allowed to curse on NPR?
Clark is now executive director of the YIMBY Action Network. They have about 1,700 members in the San Francisco Bay Area. But they also have chapters across the country. They're in Austin, Denver, New York, pretty much anywhere where rents and home prices are rising. YIMBYs go to those boring zoning board and city council meetings you see on cable access, and they push for new housing projects.
I got asked so many times, who's paying you to be here? And I was like, no one could pay me to care this much.
In California and in most other states, multiple public hearings are needed for new housing to get approved. And that's just the first of many regulatory steps before a shovel can actually touch dirt.
CEQA, initial study, environmental impact report, notice of public hearing, design review, architectural review.
David Garcia is a housing researcher at the Turner Center for Housing Innovation at UC Berkeley. He's listing all the regulatory hoops that California developers have to jump through.
The number of bedrooms required in the project as a percentage of the overall project.
Garcia says that individually, each rule may make sense. But collectively, all those regulations create uncertainty for developers, which raises costs.
In America, we've created this system where every single project needs to be poked and prodded and examined before we've given it a thumbs up that, you know, this project can build and more people can live in our communities.
He says it's tough to estimate how much exactly these regulations add to housing prices. But the costs and lengthy delays are a major reason not enough housing gets built. And the YIMBYs are now looking to elected leaders to trim those regulations. Earlier this year, the YIMBYs scored their biggest political victory yet. Democrat London Breed was elected the new mayor of San Francisco.
And I plan to change the politics of no to the politics of yes. Yes, we will build more housing.
The YIMBYs campaigned for Breed, who made building new housing a major part of her platform. They're hoping Breed can help dismantle what the YIMBYs consider the Voldemort of housing regulations, single-family zoning. Here again is YIMBY Executive Director Laura Foote Clark.
Right now in San Francisco, over a third of our parcels are zoned single-family home only, where it is illegal to build multifamily apartments.
The YIMBYs have their detractors. They've run afoul of some anti-gentrification groups who say new construction threatens their communities. They're often criticized for being too cozy with the Bay Area's tech industry, who provides a lot of their funding. But even those who sympathize with the YIMBY's agenda sometimes just don't like their tone.
This is the spot where the zucchini was. It's cucumbers this year. I have tomatoes, garlic.
Scout Shays, a.k.a. the zucchini lady, shows me her backyard, right next door to where those two new Berkeley houses would have been built. In retrospect, she regrets bringing the zucchini. She knows how petty she comes off. But she says she was really there to support the renters in the house next door, who she thought were being unfairly treated by the developer. The YIMBYs didn't support the project because of those concerns.
When the YIMBYs come and say that I'm opposed to affordable housing, that's not what I am.
Ironically, Shays is exactly the type of person the YIMBYs need to expand their political clout. She's young, progressive, and sympathetic to the argument that we need to build more housing. But she's also a homeowner who likes her garden, and she still doesn't want shadows cast in her backyard. For Here and Now, I'm Matt Levin.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.